Welcome to PDGA Radio with Grant Zellner and Jennifer Allen. Our guest this week, Avery Jenkins, the 2009 Professional Disc Golf World Champion, a man with an incredible career and now one that has ventured into all sorts of things as an ambassador for the game of disc golf worldwide, including a number of disc golf course designs, a number that is growing literally as we speak. Funny story, though. As we began our conversation, Avery, who lives in a pretty rural part of the United States, an area that I'm familiar with, I used to live there myself, he experienced some internet issues, which caused the first couple of minutes of our conversation to be, well, lost in the cloud somewhere. So we join our conversation a little bit in progress, but you didn't miss much. Writing. In an area where, you know, cable TV and you know, internet signals and things like that, you know, you've got kind of one service provider there in a small town. So you're kind of at the mercy. Hey, you're back.
There I am. Starlink finally kicked in again.
Starlink. Yeah. That's what you're using. Yeah. Well, good for Starlink. Well, Avery, I mean, let's just start back at the beginning. We've been talking about this last chapter of your life, if you will, and maybe one of the longest stints you've ever had at one address. But people that recognize your name, even those newer to disc golf that recognize your name, the reason why isn't necessarily because of recent events. It's because of upbringing. It's because you and your sister are part of a disc golf family. And we had your sister on with your brother-in-law, what, a year and a half ago or something like that, talking about, of course, Nate and Valerie Doss. And so why don't we start there with your take on your upbringing, part of a disc golf family that went around and just played disc golf in an era when that maybe wasn't all that common.
Yeah. Yeah. We grew up in a family, you know, playing sports, whether it was baseball, basketball, football. We always participated in various sports, and Frisbee was just one of those. I started playing disc golf when I was 6 years old. You know, it was just, again, one of those backyard fun activities. We play catch. We always had baskets in the backyard, and we lived 15 minutes from a disc golf course. The disc golf course that was our home course is the oldest course in the state of Ohio. Designed by Steady Ed in 1978. So that kind of maybe drew my history and passion for the sport, knowing what he established, what he brought to town, eventually influenced several, if not hundreds, if not thousands of disc golfers, namely our family being, you know, my mother, my father, who were the caretakers and took on head pro and kind of caretaking responsibilities of the course. And then Val and I just, you know, grew up in a disc golf family where we're at the course most of the time throughout the week and definitely on the weekends. You know, we didn't start off playing full rounds of golf. We would maybe go out and play a few holes and go play in the creek for a couple hours. But like, it became something that we did as a family that we always did for as long as I remember, you know, and starting off early, 6 years old, Val started when she was, you know, probably a year or two old. She was always involved, wow, and ingrained into the sport. And that always came around to, you know, family trips and road trips, involving camping and getting out there as a family, but then also and always involved a disc golf tournament or two along the way.
What year were you born so we can give like theater of radio.
I'm a 70s child, so 1978. I'm 45 years old, and so I started around 83 84.
Okay, there we go.
Yep, early 80s, mid 80s.
Avery, that means it's time for you to break the 45 WIFDIF distance comp. Like distance
it's
record, right?
There. It's just sitting right there.
Record at 45.
I think it's Chris Max. I think still holds it. I think. Yeah. It's
do you
different.
Know what it is?
Probably 650 something. I would think. 650s, 680s maybe. But at elevation, as Jen knows, it's different. You can get one out there and get one up there, and it you can get it sailing pretty good though too, depending on the conditions. So yeah, it's something to consider for sure.
So WIFDIF for our PDGA listeners still goes by the previous age brackets. So they go 30. Well, do they start Do they start 30, 35?
35 is Masters. It's the first one.
35, 40, 45, 50. So the PDGA went away from that and is 40, 50, and now 55, 65.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah. So when we hit 45 and we like to throw distance, you know, it's something to look at.
It opens up other considerations for sure. It gives you another chance at it. Yeah. Yep. But yeah, back to it. It's always been a part of my life from a very young age and ingrained and instilled in us at a very young age, but never forced upon us. And just something that we realized when we played locally, even at the junior levels, playing locally and maybe regionally, we got pretty good at it. And we were winning events and tournaments and small leagues and such. And we just knew that we just kind of kept at it. We progressively got better. And a lot of these trips and travels always involved like some bigger tournaments. And a lot of times it was even like the world championships that my parents started playing. I think their first one was 1991. So I've literally been to every single Worlds on site competing or just there since 1991. Kid, as an amateur, as a pro, all the way up till now. So that's a pretty good run. It was always something I was always a part of. And my parents being so in depth into disc golf, I have a lot of history with it. I have a lot of friends. A lot of their friends are my friends, and they're like some of the most, pioneers of our sport that we're very fortunate to know through my parents and my upbringing within the sport of disc golf.
And now you have a couple of little boys that you get to kind of do the same thing. Has that been fun to be on the other side of it now, being able to be dad teaching?
It's been great showing them the way for sure. My boys have been to a lot of disc golf tournaments. They've been to several world championships over the last couple of years, even this past one in Vermont, bringing the whole family up. And then with the Tulsa World Championships this summer, it is about bringing my oldest. He turns 9 here in 2 weeks.
Oh my gosh. He'll
play the 10 and under. And Arian, he's been playing since he could walk. And with the courses outside and the practice area and the putting baskets outside, we have played for the last 9 years, essentially, and never played anything organized and never played anything competitive. So I want to kind of bring him into that. He's a natural athlete, loves soccer, loves basketball, loves baseball. And I never really pushed the disc golf thing on him. It's just something we do. And so when my mom was here this past summer, I had her take him out on rounds and they would just go play. Not me pushing the sport on him as a father, but letting grandma come out there and throw some shots and kind of convince him that, this is something he'd really want to do. And I hope we can convince him over the next, couple of months that we need to start practicing and training and getting ready for the Worlds. I'd be very, very proud. It'd probably definitely get me to tear up a little bit if he's out there playing the World Championships in his junior ranks.
Yeah, it's so cool because now there's this whole group of us that have kids that play. Brinster's kids will be out there, and there's so many other, old OG disc golfers that have their kids out there playing now. So it is super fun to go to the Junior Worlds or Am Worlds, and you get to see your fellow competitors watching their kids play. Yeah. So it is really a cool thing. Grant and I will both be there, so we will all be cheering him
awesome.
Coming back to our Okie roots up in Tulsa.
Yeah, it's supposed to be my turn to go to the European Open. My group of staff at the PDGA, we sort of, for that particular trip, we don't, all hands on deck for that trip. It would just be too logistically and financially just ridiculous. So we sort of rotate it, and it's my turn in the rotation, I think. I say, my coworkers are listening to this and some of them might be saying, no, it's not. I think it is. I might be wrong, but assuming it is, I was like, I can't not be at Tulsa because the European Open and Junior Worlds are both the same week this year. I was like, I can't not be at Tulsa. That's where I grew up. It's where I was born. That's where some of my favorite courses are and where I learned a lot about the game. I gotta go to Tulsa. So I'm putting I've never been to Europe. So I'm putting my first ever trip across any ocean on pause just to make sure I'm there in Tulsa.
Are you sure it's the same weekend? You just got a shocker out of me for the fact that I have my flights booked to Europe already.
No, it is the same. It's the same week. Going.
Oh, you're kidding me. Damn. I got some.
Hey.
To break the news.
Oh, jeez. Nice. Yeah, I haven't missed a European Open ever. I've been every European inception in 2006. So this would be like, I think, my 12th European Open I've been to. Got to weigh some things out.
Maybe call Yusi, see what he can do.
Yeah. Honestly, oh, my gosh. Okay.
Sorry about that. Yeah.
Yeah, thanks. That's, you got the PDGA schedule in front of you, of course. Yeah.
What a
The schedule this year has been so frustrating for a lot of us who've played for so many years. Not so much the new players that only like hit the Disc Golf Pro Tour, but all of us who have these, you know, like the Santa Cruz, the Masters Cup, you know, all the Goat Hills kind of became one of those. Vegas also now. All of these older tournaments that we always kind of hit, this year they coincide with so many. Beaver State Fleeing I'm going to miss because of Masters Worlds. We're going to miss Green Mountains. It's scheduled with the Tim Zielinski. So there's quite a few conflicts on the schedule this year. It has been hard to kind of pick and choose. And you just kind of have to go with which, I guess, holds your heart the most.
Wow. It was only a matter of time before there was going to be conflicts with so many great events. But yeah. You mm-hmm. think historically would hold a precedent, and then you go, all right, we're not definitely holding it on Santa Cruz weekend. We're definitely not holding on Beaver State weekend. And this, you're talking about majors, you know, being held on those same weekends.
Yeah. It's hard.
That's what it is now. You got to pick and choose where you want to go and where you want to be. And sometimes it aligns with the tour and the travel. Sometimes you're crisscrossing. That's something we've always tried to work out over the last 20 years, is really trying to make something that's more, navigable, and you can route it a little better, but it's what it is. But it's amazing to see where it is and where it's at. And obviously there's those conflicts because of so many events out there now.
Right.
A few
right.
years from now, it's going to be like Netflix. You're going to have so many options. You'll just sit there and not make a decision at all. You won't know where to go.
Maybe we'll have that many channels too. Maybe like, let's flip it down to this channel, watch this event. And
they'll be just, you'll have lots of top level options on most weekends, especially through the warmer part of, at least in the Northern Hemisphere, the warmer part of the year. And anymore, Jen, I mean, you've been going down to Australia and things like that. And I know, Avery, you've traveled the world. I mean, anymore, there's stuff going on in that part of the world that is what used to be the off season for us in this part. So now there's no off season, and
pretty much,
I mean, it's a good problem to have, even with the growing pains that people like you and Avery feel, because things that are dear to you have to get sort of interrupted and sort of shuffled around. And I know that's not the most fun, but you know, you got a puppy barking in the background. Can you guys hear that?
Did my dog barking make your dog?
No, this is a first. I've had this little dog for not all that long, for a few months now. And this is the first time she's found her voice. She used to not understand the concept of windows, and that if you look out a window for long enough, something's bound to happen outside. Well, she discovered windows a few weeks ago. And now she goes to windows, waits for something to happen, and then barks at it because that makes sense to her.
Yeah.
So apologies to the viewers and listeners.
No worries.
Avery, you, if you were born in 78, I was born in 80. So that makes you a high school graduate roughly around 97 ish, right? Somewhere in there.
Yep.
So that's where your junior career of disc golf and other sports for that matter, maybe kind of transitioned. I don't know. What did you do when it comes to turning pro in disc golf, or fitting disc golf in with maybe any post high school sports? I mean, how did that season of your life go? Cause we're still a number of years away from the years where people might be really familiar with you in terms of your world championship and stuff. So help us bridge that gap from late '90s to, you know, mid 2000 aughts.
Sure. I played a lot of still, you know, doing the high school thing into college. I actually stopped playing for a little while. I wasn't just involved with, you know, I had a girlfriend, had a job, had other responsibilities, and I wasn't playing a whole lot of golf through high school and even like beginning part of college. Play a couple tournaments here and there. It wasn't until, you know, 2000, you know, a couple years into college that I started playing disc golf again at a high level, you know, playing my last year of amateur advanced in 99, and then playing my first year of pro in 2000. Played a lot of local regional events. I won 7 tournaments that year, my first rookie year. I won a big A tiers being the biggest events you could play besides a major back then. And I ended up beating the current world champion at the time, the 1999 world champion, Ron Russell, in Toronto for my first big A tier win. And that kind of catapulted me into a great season and winning 2000 Rookie of the Year. So I got the PDGA Rookie of the Year that season. And that kind of really set kind of the stage for a lot of things to come. In 2001, went on tour for the first time. 2001, 2002 with Dave Fellberg and Todd Branch, two high level touring pros, seasoned veterans at that time, because they've been touring for a couple years already, and jumped on the road with them in a 1978 Winnebago and traveled full time, playing 45 tournaments a year for 2 years straight. And that's when I really got conditioned into playing at a high level, but also playing to survive and stay on the road. Like, this is a time when we weren't making a lot of money at tournaments, and sponsorships weren't then what they are now. And, you know, a lot of times you're trying to place top fives, top tens, just to be able to afford, you know, entry fees, food, and then gas to the next tournament. Like, you're playing for strictly survival. And it made us play harder. It made us be a little more cutthroat, I think. And it meant so much more to us. And also back in the day when they only paid the top third in most of these fields. Today they pay 40%, 50%, and we were paying 33%. And that was a hard cap deadline. And how many times I've missed cash by a stroke on the final hole, missing a putt, you know, it's like, it definitely scars you a little bit, but makes you a better player in their long run. And we earned everything. We had to earn everything. It was just so much more diehard then. Now it's, I'm not saying it's a cakewalk by any means, but players are given a lot more than we were given, and we earned a lot more for what we were given at the time. So it was a different time. At early years, we were very early on the tour days. We were only probably one of maybe 10 or 12 touring pros at the time. We had a small caravan of players that would play throughout the year in every single event. But we weren't the first. There was players, you know, even before us in the 90s, you know, Ron Russell and even Greenwell, even to early 80s, you know, late 80s, that were doing this. So we're like kind of maybe the second or third generation of touring pros, but definitely pioneers on the road as road warriors for those, you know, early 2000s, that we established ourselves as touring pros and kind of made a name for ourselves then. So that's like where we really cut our teeth to be the players that we were and set us up to be the players that we're going to be.
Give our listeners an idea of what kind of prize money, and if you can, this might be a little more delicate, but if you can, even an idea of whatever income you could generate, not prize money, but through, you know, how sponsorships might have worked in that era. Give us an idea of what living like that was like.
So traveling on a home on wheels, living in a motorhome, going from location to location, a lot of times we would stay with friends, park outside their house, even plug in. We didn't have a shower or bathroom in the motorhome itself. So a lot of times we would just, you know, either stay at their house, or sometimes even one or two of us would sleep in the house. But a lot of times it was all about definitely that disc golf gypsy life of traveling and touring at a very affordable level. And prize money, you know, a good size tournament, a good B tier, you might still win, you know, $500. Maybe some larger ones, you might win the $600-$700 range. Top tier, A tier events, you're maybe clearing $1,000, $1,200, $1,500 on bigger ones. And then even majors, you're still clearing maybe $3,000, $4,000, $5,000. You're not winning a whole lot of money back then.
But you're not winning every week either. I mean, you're just talking about if you won, but you're having other, you know, this week you finish fifth, this week you finish eighth. This, the field's only, you know, so many people at a smaller event that's in between two bigger events in some, you know, out of the way town. I mean, so at the end of a decent month, you're making in prize money, if you're lucky, you know what, $1,500, $2,000 on average, not counting if you win like a major here and there, but just a run of the mill April.
Yeah.
You know, you're pooling that with the other guys in the bus and spending that on gas and everything else. What about off the course revenue, for lack of a better term? Are you really getting much from sponsors? Or are you just getting discs that you turn around and try to sell for 10 or at the time, you know, 10 or 12 bucks a pop?
Yeah, definitely on the disc golf hustle. We were definitely vending and selling discs. We were running events, doubles events, kind of even popping in and playing weekly leagues and such at various spots. But outside sponsorship, even, you know, through when I got sponsored by Innova in 2000, it was mostly kind of just entry fees and gear, plastic, you know, discs, apparel, whatever we could get, and maybe a couple trips here and there. But it was really just bare bones. Here's your tournament entry fees. Here's your discs and apparel and your gear. And then you get performance bonuses depending on how you played. And that's one way we generate money outside of just tournament, you know, earnings. And so even throughout a season, you know, a great season, you're clearing, if you're playing good, you're making $30,000 in a year just playing on tournament earnings. And then maybe you can get a little bit on the side through sponsorship. But there's many years where I was, you know, $20,000 or $25,000 for a year playing 30, 35, 40 events.
Yeah. And spending what, 10 grand of that just in all of your expenses, getting around and all that kind of stuff?
By 10, 15. Wow. Yeah. Yeah. So you're cutting that in half pretty quick. And it was more about the adventure. You know, I was 22 years old and getting to travel the country and see the world. And I was doing it bare bones, very affordable, and getting to play disc golf every day of the week. And that's what it was about. It wasn't about what you're earning or what you're making or what you're going to end the year with. It was about being out there playing, the travels and adventures along the side. You know, the tournaments were one thing, but then everything we did Monday through Friday was, you know, life-changing as well. And in the end, you just hope you had a great year. You had a lot of fun. You came home with a little bit of money in your pocket and you made a name for yourself. So that's what all we were trying to do throughout a season was establish us as players on the tour and try to make a name for ourselves, you know, going forward for years to come.
It was definitely a time when having a career was going to make you more money than being a disc golfer. Been recently that you can say, oh my gosh, these guys are making more than they would make if they went to work a 9 to 5. So, I mean, that's just such a recent thing. There was so many events. If you won, you might break even with your travel.
Sure.
So that's just how it was. So this is definitely a new thing that people can actually earn a salary and money that would be equivalent to having a 9 to 5.
Sure. And to even go into like the touring pros before us, we were the first generation of touring pros that could actually stay out on tour and just play disc golf exclusively. There was a lot of other players before us that were tournament touring kind of players that would, you know, work Monday through Thursday, leave on the weekend, play a tournament, make a couple $100, and then go back to a day job Monday through Thursday. We were the first to say we could be on tour and live on tour sustainably and be out there for a long time. So they set us up to be who we were. And then, you know, without taking too much credit, we set a lot of the players up beyond us to now make a living and get a salary and get bonuses and get signing bonuses and signature discs and everything else to be true on touring pros and maybe not even be on tour where they can fly in, fly out and stay home during the week and then fly out for the weekend. So it's just the evolution of the sport. And I'm just glad to be a part of it, even at the beginning.
You've got more than 50 professional victories. And in the era that you've just been talking about, you're going up against the likes of Ken Climo and Dave Feldberg. And these are the guys that you're battling during this particular season, but we're still a couple of years away from your world title. So what was it like? You Kenny's last years of total dominance, not that he wasn't still formidable, but his last years of just, you know, practically winning every time I got out of the car, it seems like, you know, that was 2005, six, somewhere in that kind of area, 2007, that was kind of where the baton was beginning to be passed, so to speak. You at that point, you're a couple of years away from your world title in 2009. So how did that happen? Because by now you're getting quite a ways away from graduating high school. Mm-hmm. And by now, maybe the call to start a quote unquote real career or whatever is beginning to pull at you. So how were things going at that point in your life? And yet you still remained in tune enough with the game to pull down a world title in 2009. What was that like?
yeah, it took a lot of years to kind of learn how to lose before you could learn how to win. And playing against the likes of, you know, your Ken Climo, your Barry Schultz, Dave Hellberg being my travel partner, companion, and touring, you know, all over the country, we made each other better, and we definitely fed off each other's talents quite a bit. He was a phenomenal player, super consistent, really good putter, and he drove me to be a better player. On top of that, you know, you're approaching a Nate Doss era. You got Steve Rico, who's been a dominant pro for many decades. And so these are the types of players that we had to play every single weekend. And sure, there was fewer of us at a top high level world class. But man, we were like at each other at every weekend, just trying to best each other. Friends off the course, but man, when you're on the course, you're still trying to beat them. You're still trying to win tournaments. And so we all made each other better. But having the Climo Schultz eras, they were definitely the idols of mine that drove me to be a better player. And then obviously having a touring companion that was a really good player drove me to be, you know, who I am as a player on the course, off the course, and definitely pushed me to, you know, strive for more. So you're looking at early 2000s, even mid 2000s, a lot of travel, just on the grind, playing a lot of tournaments, on the tour every single year. Off season's pretty mellow, but just kind of waiting, you know, biting at the bit, waiting to get back out there. But it wasn't until like you're looking at mid 2000s, 2007, 8, 9 is when I really started kind of picking up the ranks. I started college and university in 2003 when I was in Oregon, and I was still through college a lot of those, you know, 3, 4, and 5. But it wasn't until I started playing Ultimate, you know, playing a lot of Ultimate Frisbee. Played disc golf my whole life, played Frisbee, but never played Ultimate. I had a pretty decent forehand, but playing Ultimate, being so active and running around, it got my forehand better. And that's when I really started accelerating, having both the forehand shot, the backhand shot, and gave me so much more versatility as a player, rounded me out and helped me become a lot more dominant on the course. And that's when I started kind of knocking down bigger wins. You know, your 2004 Japan Open, and then I won 2006 Champions Cup, both these being majors, leading up to bigger events and national tour events until accumulating to a 2009 world title in Kansas City.
Well, and at that time, and Jen, you can attest to this because it influenced your game, you know, a forehand was, it might be overstating it to say it was a trick shot, but a forehand wasn't really a standard disc golf throw. It was whether you were left-handed or right-handed, you were throwing those early day dishes backhand to get the most out of them and the most versatility, until some people started coming along and playing with the forehand and then turning it more and more into a reliable and versatile, you know, tool in its own right. So it sounds like you were almost, I don't know if leading edge is overstating it, but it sounds like you were apt to use it maybe in an era where it was finally becoming a little bit more in vogue.
Yeah. I think the first person I really saw use the forehand or the sidearm shot to a very high level was Scott Stokely. He was the one I learned the forehand from. I credit a lot of what I've seen and watched from him and even learned from him over the years, but he was like using it, you know, mid 90s, early 2000s, and he has a finals in 2000. He made the finals throwing some at the Great Lakes Open, throwing some crazy over the top shots, what people would never consider, you know, stuff that Simon would consider now being Simon lines. They were Stokely lines back in the day. And he was the one that was the most dominant on the forehand shot. And knowing that if I can take the shot, finishing both, you know, right to left and left to right, gave me so much more variation and variety and gave me so much more opportunity to score. And so learning that, I wasn't the first to use it, but I was probably one of the most dominant in my era that used it predominantly. I wouldn't say, I was probably more a 75-25 kind of guy. Still 75, very heavy on the backhand still, but would throw the forehand largely when it made the most sense and for longer distance shots where I need a shot to finish left to right. And it allowed me to be a lot more versatile as a player, to be more, you know, more opportunities for birdie on the course.
Tell us about 2009 Worlds in Kansas City. I mean, yeah. What just what when you think about that, when you close your eyes and try to remember, I'm sure so many of those details are etched in your memory. Tell us about what that week was like. This is in an era, by the way, for those newer to disc golf, when a world championship was six, at that time it was six rounds, you know, plus a semifinal round, plus a final nine. I mean, you're playing a lot of holes of disc golf. We don't play quite that long anymore. You know, tell us about that week.
It's a disc golf marathon is what a world championship was considered. And really, as Klima would always say, the cream always rises to the top. You know, it was really hard to beat Ken Klima at a world championship because, man, you're lucky if you're going to beat him for a round or two, but you're not beating him over seven rounds, eight rounds, nine and a half rounds. I think the 2000 Worlds was nine and a half plus a final nine, or including the final nine. It was incredible. So if you were to edge him for a round or two or get close to him, sure, you weren't beating him over that time. So it was a full on, very endurance focused, very stamina. And you're playing a variety of courses. You're not just playing one course four times or two courses four times, you know, at this point. You're playing a variety of courses. So in 2009, being in Kansas City, definitely peaking, playing really good golf and knowing that we're going to Kansas City, it's about bigger, more open courses. And that caters really well to how I play the game. And knowing that, you know, going into this, I have a really good chance. Never won a KC Wide Open, but played really well at KC Wide Opens, you know, playing different waterworks, Swope, you know, Cliff Drive, Blue Valley, various courses we played for the World Championships, and played really well in those courses. So knowing it was going to be in Kansas City, knowing what the whole Kansas City, you know, vibe is all about, I was really motivated. And playing Blue Valley, being a very distance heavy kind of course, that's kind of where I set the pace. First round out there was in a kind of a light rain. Wasn't the most ideal for a opening round of for the World Championships, but I went out there in a slight drizzle and shot a course record 13 down with a couple splash outs and an ace that spit out at one point on like the 13th or 14th hole. Everything was just dialed. And so I ended up shooting a 53 on a par 66 to take a five or six stroke lead just to start off the World Championships. Like that just got me, you know, jacked just to even push harder and push that pedal a little harder. And going into several other rounds at Rosedale and Cliff Drive. And I think we played another Thornfield course, a private course. We played five different courses throughout seven and a half rounds. And so you didn't get a lot of chances or second chances at many of these holes. So you had to play at a high level and capitalize on the holes that you did play. And there was times, you know, there's players that got close in the lead card, then would fall off. Another couple of players get to the lead card, fall off. But I held that lead through, I think, five rounds. And I think it was like the fifth round at Cliff Drive. I think it was an afternoon round in the day where we played two rounds a day, not just one. And so even if you came out in the morning and you're on fire, you'd have a lunch and you have a break and maybe you cool down a little bit, or you'd have a maybe too heavy of a lunch, or you wouldn't have the right lunch, or it's hot or cold or whatever. And the afternoon round was always different. It was a little more definitely focused on endurance and knowing that everybody's going to get tired at some point. You just kind of push through. And I remember Matty O went out there and I think he shot a 10 or a 12, put up like another really, really great round or course record round. And I shot terrible. And this is the time where Josh Anthon was on my heels and he had surpassed me. And the next day, knowing that we're kind of going closer to semifinals round, I was pretty down on my luck and not feeling great about it, holding the lead at the Worlds and then thinking it's all going to slip away. Sitting back, having an in-depth conversation with Nate Doss. You know, he's 2007, 2000. He won the 2005, the 2007 World Championships, two-time world champ, good friend of mine. And we sat back and he's like, you got two options. You know, you got two options at this point. You let it slip and slide and you fall to the bottom, or you just go at it. Do everything you did to get to the top and remain at the top. You need to push again. It's not a short tournament. You just got to outlast them. You got all the skill to do it. Just keep pushing. And so we got two options. And at that option, I was not going to fall off. I was in position to win a world championship. There's no way I was going to hold me back. We go out to play a practice round that afternoon after that talk. and we go out to Waterworks. Jen, you know that course well. It's iconic. It overlooks downtown Kansas City. Hole number one might be the best number one in the game. Like, it's the one of the best starting holes in the sport. And I remember throwing a shot, it's like 550, side hill, double ravine, and I tagged the top of the basket on a practice shot. And I was like, let's go. I'm fired up. Play a practice round through, got all the holes dialed, come back out there the next morning to a semifinal, shoot like a nine down, recapture the lead. And then I'm two strokes up going into the final nine. And there's a long break of other activities going on, the world championship. But it's a long day. After you play your semifinal round, you go over to Blue Valley and we play our finals. At that point, I meet up with Sister Valerie. She's, I think, six strokes up at that point, on her third world title. You know, she won 2007, 2008, and she's going for a third in 2009. And an agreement we made early in the week was, you win yours, I'll win mine. She goes out there, the walk in the park, she ends up taking it down, winning hers. She comes back in. I haven't even started my final round yet, or my final nine yet. And she's like, seal the deal. Let's make it happen. So I go out there, and it's me, Josh Anthon, Matt Oram, and Caleb Visca. That's our top four in the final nine at 2009 Worlds. All notable players, all great players in their own right. Many, you know, major events and national tours and disc golf pro tour event champions. And yeah, some of the best players at the time. And I have probably arguably one of the best putters chasing me down. Josh Anthon's deadly with the putter. Anything inside 50s, you can count. He's either drawing metal or making it. And so there was a couple decisions in there that I played a little aggressive, that I was maybe losing focus at some point. And after the final nine, that final nine there, I was up by three strokes at one time, and he ended up birdieing the sixth, the seventh, and the eighth holes where I parred him to tie me up. And then we par the last hole to remain tied after the final nine with a world title on the line. This is going to be, I believe, the second sudden death playoff ever at a world championship. The first being in 1987, between Mike Sullivan and Greg Hosfeld in Toronto, being the only, world championship up to that point outside of the US. And so this is going to be the second sudden death playoff. And knowing kind of what the repercussions are, it's everything. And we had played through four holes of sudden death, kind of matching each other, you know, birdie for birdie or par for par. And it came down the final hole, the fifth hole, where it's an uphill shot about 350. And he had pulled his shot about 45 to the right. Capitalizing on that, knowing there's a crosswind, I threw an overstable Firebird, put it up there about 23 feet. And walking up, didn't really pay attention to what he's doing, just really focused on what I had to do. And he had missed wide right on a putt from 45. And I went up there with everything on the line at 23, 22 feet. And it was intense knowing what this meant and what was going to happen. But trying to take yourself out of that mindset, knowing that everybody's there is 2,000 spectators and gallery around you, but putting yourself in a happy place, knowing that this is a putt you made thousands of times before. Why would now be any different than any other time? And I try to put myself in the backyard practicing, you know, as a kid, and leading up to it, 25 footer, lined it up, took my time, made everybody disappear. It was me in the basket. And, I made a promise to myself that I was going to leave it all on the line. And with the release of that putt and the disc striking the chains, I let out like a big roar, knowing that I captured the title and I proved everything that I could ever prove within the sport with that putt, you know, and that performance and that championship in 2009. But what made it more special was Val was the one that came up running up the hill, and just in the air, I caught her. And so the first brother and sister to win a world title side by side, her winning her third and me winning my first, for the Team Jenkins victory.
That's wild. I mean,
a little bit of goosebumps recap.
Yeah.
It's always nice to relive it. And I get to relive it every once in a while during interviews like this, but, it was intense. It was insane. It was everything you worked for. All the early mornings, all the rounds you didn't want to go out and play in the rain, or the snow and the ice or windy rounds or rounds or weekends, you just didn't feel like playing disc golf or playing a tournament, especially when you're on tour, you didn't take weekends off. And this made it all worth it. This was everything you worked for. And it all accumulated to that one pinnacle of my career to be on top and obviously take that down.
And how life-changing. I mean, yeah. I can even just think if we flip that story, if Josh would have hit that putt and yours would have chained out, you know,
yeah,
Josh's life might have been a totally different path as well. Like winning such a major event is a life-changing event. And especially back then, now maybe even more. And I think, you know, looking at Kristen winning the Grand Slam this last year, like those things just don't happen very often. And I think sometimes people kind of forget that. Maybe they get used to seeing the same people win, but that's really hard to do. It's hard to just win one. So yeah, when you can start racking a few of them up and like Val was able to do and Dez and Juliana, like these people are incredible to be able to just continue that. Just it's amazing.
I want to give a little bit of perspective for listeners that are maybe not quite as versed in some chapters of disc golf history, because to me, this particular World Championships, it's like if you had a Venn diagram of, you know, old school and then players that a lot of people have heard of now and maybe have followed for a number of years and things. If you had a Venn diagram, those two circles, they overlapped right here at this particular Worlds. I'm just going to skim through the list here of players that were at this Worlds and name some names with apologies to anybody that I accidentally skip over. But some people that were at this Worlds, Jeremy Colling was at this Worlds. James Conrad, future world champion, played in this Worlds. Paul Omen played in this Worlds. Philo Brathwaite, Eric McCabe, a world champion. Jay Redding was a player in this world. Johnny McRae. I mean, some of these people that I'm just saying, people picture them and they're picturing, a more mature version of that person, should I say. They're picturing a gray beard or something, but we're talking about them in younger days. Brinster was there. Paul McBeth was there. Some people from outside the U.S. Manabu Kajiyama was there. Jesper Lundmark was there. Marcus Kallstrom, a name that some people maybe have heard if they're of a certain age. Barry Schultz, I think, mentioned Nate Doss. Paul Ulibarri was there. Ken Climo was still playing. This was before he stepped away from the game for a season. Greg Barsby, getting close to the top, people that were just outside of making that final nine. Nico LeCastro, Dave Fellberg, Nate Sexton just missed out on the final nine. And then you already mentioned who was in the final nine with you. Matt Orem. People look at Matt Orem and go, oh, he's not really, you know, he's not an old guy, and he's not, but he's been playing a real long time. Yep. And he was right there in the hunt at this world. So it's a pretty incredible list to go through. And I want to go down to FPO as well, because as you mentioned, your sister winning her third world title. Hang on. I'm looking for it. There it is. She won her third in a row. Dez Redding came in second that particular day. Some other names people might've heard of, Liz Lopez played in this World Championships. I mean, Birgitta Lagerholm played in this. Some people may have heard of Birgitta. So many, and I, by the way, apologies if I've used a last name that maybe doesn't apply anymore. But it was a pretty incredible blending of what we now look back and kind of see as a couple of different eras in the world of disc golf at that particular time. And then, and you have this story to be able to sort of bring it all together. Not only in general, but you and your sister, you know, merging the same year, playing this and both winning a world title in the same year. That's iconic.
Insane.
Definitely insane. Probably won't happen again. I mean, I can't think of any.
It's so difficult. It's so difficult to do it on your own. Right. But to have two siblings at that level, the stars got to align perfectly for that to happen.
Yeah. Mom and Dad were pretty darn proud.
Oh my gosh, it was peak. It was peak Team Jenkins at the time.
Yeah, just a couple of beers probably were drank at that moment. This is before breweries, but
and this is also what leads into the reason Valinator Valinate, this whole championship leading into a players party where we're having the time of our lives on top of the world at this point, and Nate Doss going around not only to me but my mom and asking not for my sister's hand in marriage, but hey, I'm in love with your sister. I want to date her. And this is,
I want to date her.
That we were traveling together. We were all friends. Nate had a girlfriend at the time up until like maybe a month or two before Worlds. And so the 2009 Worlds is not only me and Val winning, it's also the start of Val and Nate dating and them becoming the Nate and Val show and Bevel Brewery and everything else they've done with their legacy. It all started from 2009 Worlds in Kansas City.
It's like, magical, it's like place. It's like the book, The Apples and a Seed, you know, there's just plant that seed, more apple trees, more apples. It's amazing how you can drill everything back to one moment.
Yeah.
Avery, after you won a world title and continue playing disc golf, though, your career has, I think it's fair to say the primary focus of your career has transitioned into what you do now. So let's bridge that gap now as kind of the final chapter of this particular podcast, which I know doesn't do justice to a life. Forgive us for that. But
yeah, we can talk hours, if not days, on disc golf. There's so many stories within stories. Yeah. But yeah, no, we definitely need to bridge the gap from more the playing days and transition to more the business side of things and what I do now.
Yeah, because a lot of people that are going to see your name on the title of this podcast, the context in which they're going to see it, if they're newer to the game of disc golf, and I'm being respectful when I say newer, because they could still have been, you know, a disc golfer for a decade now, but they're going to see Avery Jenkins. They're going to think that, you know, the last time I saw that name was when I saw it in connection to a course. Avery Jenkins designed, and then insert the name of the course in any of a gazillion locales. That's where they know you from. So you are part of, shall we say, a movement of people that got into the game of disc golf and found a way to make it a career, if you will, but not necessarily just as a professional player, you know, trying to win prize money and get sponsorships. You turned it into other ventures that continue to this day. Talk to us about what prompted you, what led you, and what opportunity presented itself that took you into the path that you are now on as a course designer and a traveler and a consultant and all of those kinds of things.
Yeah, it was, I feel it was like a very natural transition. Going back to a point Jen was making, really, this provided me an opportunity and it definitely springboarded me into this position. Without winning Worlds, who knows what I do if I'm still involved in the sport, and I'm probably not involved in the sport at this level or this capacity. And so it definitely generated a lot more drive and passion in me to stay involved. I don't think I was going anywhere. I would probably still be involved at some capacity, but who knows what it would have been. And a world title, putting that kind of that accolade behind you, it definitely gave me a lot more opportunity and still does to this day, even what I do now within the business. So working through and into the disc golf business, what I am now, I work for Discmania. I am the sales manager of Disc Golf Park. That is the course design side of Discmania, but I'm also the team manager of Discmania as well, overseeing a 60 player roster. And so I wear many hats within the company. I was sponsored by Innova Discs for 20 years. Definitely one of the faces of the brand for a long time. And players might even know my name because of, you know, various signature discs I've had. The Destroyer being very iconic and still the best, if not one of the best distance drivers ever, even whatever it is, almost, wow.
We're talking about,
you know, 2007 is when the Destroyer came out, but we're looking at, you know, 15, 16, 18 years down the road and still a very sought after disc.
Still have a couple in my bag with your name.
No, you do. I know you do. And so I still get a lot of players coming up to me with AJ signature Destroyers and having me sign those. And even after that, I transitioned to the Avery Jenkins T-Bird. And having signature discs definitely kept my name alive and my brand alive beyond my playing years. So a lot of players might know me from certain signature discs that they hopefully collect or still throw. But working within the business, working within the industry, this is everything I wanted to be a part of. as a player kind of transitioning out of the competitive side, I wanted to be part of the business side. And so one thing I'm very grateful for that, you know, maybe I didn't bank on a massive contract and getting, you know, $500,000 to $1 million a year. I got into disc golf and I'm still involved in disc golf at a very high level. There's not a day that goes by that I don't do something disc golf related. It's crazy. It's so ingrained in what I do. With every phone call, with every email, it's something disc golf related. And maybe not an opportunity that I would have had otherwise, you know, and I think a lot of other players that are on the salary now, they might not have an opportunity to work within disc golf, you know, beyond, because there's only certain, so many companies, there's only certain, so many manufacturers, there's only so many positions that are open and available for certain disc golfers beyond their playing years. And I don't think a lot of those positions are going to be available after they're done playing at a competitive level. So I'm fortunate for that. Things work out the way they do, and I'm very grateful for what I'm involved in now. And transitioning, I take care of the team. I oversee the team, being a team player and sponsor player. Like I said, for 20 years with Innova, there was opportunity, but then there wasn't a whole lot beyond being a player. And that's when I transitioned from Innova into Discmania. We were partner companies for several years. I was co-sponsored for many of those years. And I saw opportunity. I saw a chance to work for a disc golf company, and I definitely took it. So with that opportunity, being a team manager and then being a sales manager for a disc golf design company was everything I've been looking for. And so nowadays, it's my day-to-day is searching out disc golf course projects, design jobs, selling equipment. And I feel like I travel now. I travel more than I've ever traveled, even when I was a touring player. Like it's insane how busy I am on a daily basis, just being involved on the disc golf course side of things.
Avery, give them an idea. What is your total now on course designs?
I am up to 55 different course designs through 32 states. And I think the run I'm at right now is I've designed a course a month for the last 3 years. So I have 36 course designs over the last 36 months. Already got a course design in January, and I have another two that I'll get in before the end of the month. Like it's stacking up pretty good. I did 13 course designs last year, 11 the year before, 11 the year before that. So it's been a wild ride. And when it comes down to course design, it's something I'm passionate about. It's not something that, I don't know, that everybody's kind of destined to do, even if they're a disc golfer. It's like teaching disc golf. Even if you play disc golf, it doesn't mean you can teach. And just because you play disc golf doesn't mean you can design a course. It's most certainly a craft. It's something I'm so passionate about and so into, but that's also because it's my hobby. Like I'm a full on diehard course collector. I have 1,550 courses played in 23 countries and 49 states. So I search out and play everything and anything. I play all the notable courses, the number ones, the high ranked courses, but I'll play just about anything just to play it and check it off a list and get the basket on the map kind of thing. So very heavy super user on UDisc. And there's a lot of other course collectors out there these days that I think there's a few of them almost approaching 3,000 courses. So I'm only half of that. Even though a lot of players put me up there as like the number one or, you know, top five, man, there's guys out there that play a lot of courses every single day, every single week, every single month. I'm just trying to keep up, but it's a passion of mine, but it helps me become a better course designer. Mm-hmm. I see certain things that I really like that I want to implement in my designs. And then I see a lot of things that I want to avoid. And I'm very aware and conscious of certain things that I want to, you know, bring into a lot of my course designs. They're very, very thoroughly thought out, with the main goal in mind is just to create the best experience possible for the player. You know, you want them to have a fun scoreable course in some areas. You want to have a difficult technical course in certain areas. But you're just really trying to create the best overall experience when you're going out there with good variety and variation. So, it's a most certainly a craft and something I'm very passionate about.
That's definitely one thing I think when I've came up to a course or someone's trying to design a course and they're not really getting a ton of expert advice, you have to play so many a variety of courses during not only just woods and open, but all different kinds or across the countries. You know, like you have to be exposed to so much, I think, before it really kind of you can see it in your eyes, you know? And so when these course designers try to put in a course and they don't have a ton of experience, it's like they have blinders on and they just don't see what could possibly be there, or they're missing things that are going to be dangerous or just won't play to the, you know, the most optimal course design that it could have been. And so I think that's just one thing of advice, you know, like if you don't have a ton of experience, but you still have the drive to put in a course, that's awesome, but get some help. Ask for some help, even if it's a phone call or two. But Avery, what would you say the best advice you could give someone who's trying to, you know, design their own course? Maybe it's on their own property. You know, maybe it's not one that's going to be public, but what would you say is like some great advice to give someone who's thinking about putting in a course?
Yeah. Reach out to a professional, like you said. Get somebody that has the experience and expertise to see it through. It's one of those things that just, it all falls in place. It's like it's a massive puzzle. Yes. And I like when things just kind of fall in line, fall in place. So a good starting point, a good ending point, good routing, good navigation, good flow. These are all things, variety, variation. You're looking for different shot shapes. You're looking just for the best variety of what a property, you're looking for the best variety of holes that the property is possible of offering. Mm-hmm. Even sometimes where you got to sacrifice maybe a world-class phenomenal hole to make two really good holes kind of thing. If there's like a really good hole and there's a really bad hole, you sometimes got to sacrifice a good hole to make two really solid holes and make it make sense. But advice is just really reach out to somebody who has the most experience.
I agree.
A lot of designers try to force things. They try to force things and they try to make a hole where it doesn't need to go. And I feel like when I go out in the woods, it's a very spiritual connection, like a meditative process where I go out there and I just go out there and wander around and just keep your eyes open. There's so many cool natural features that you want to put on display, whether it's old growth trees or rock outcroppings or certain topography or undulation of the land, and incorporating that in the design. A lot of people, a lot of players, a lot of designers miss a lot of key features just because they want to make the course a certain way and not letting the land dictate what that course design needs to be or should be. But man, it's a lot of fun getting out there in the woods, and every single course, no matter if it's a small school 6-hole course, 9-hole course, or a massive pro level tournament level course, they're all difficult. There's always a challenge to it. And that just proves that disc golf course design is not easy, and it never should be. It should be a challenge. You should try to challenge yourself. It shouldn't be a walk in. Here's tee pad of one, basket of one, tee pad of two, basket of two. You should have a lot more thought into it. And then once you think you have a design down, you flip it. You flip the script. You walk it backwards. The line I always say is I walk the property forwards, backwards, sideways, and upside down. You want to find the best variety holes that property is possibly can offer, you know, on design. So you got to look at every single way. Even when I think I have it, I got to second guess myself because I'm like, man, what if it did this? And then it makes this hole do this. Is that better route? Do I take it clockwise? Do I take it counterclockwise? Where do I start? Where I finish? It's about the whole navigation and routing of a course that makes the course truly what it's supposed to be.
Right. And I love how you say like the natural design to it, because you see those course designers that try to force something. Next thing you know, you got five mandos trying to force you to throw this shot. And it's just not natural. I don't know if that's more of like the old school style that we were used to, but I think a course needs to look as natural and, you know, not disturbing nature coming in and playing on this property. And yes, mandos are needed for safety occasionally, but not to force a shot. So, I definitely think that's some great advice.
Yeah, thank you. I'm definitely anti-Mando crew. I might have over 55 courses. I might have three Mandos on holes just because it's like, you know, I have a course outside Fort Collins, Colorado at the Budweiser Brewery.
Yeah.
And there's areas where you're throwing near a parking lot and I want to force a shot over the actual green space of the fairway and not, you know, a big forehand over the parking lot or something. So very few Mandos, only when they make sense. But man, there's always ways to even avoid putting a Mando in with repositioning the tee pad or forcing a certain shot or angle. But yeah, you got to let the property talk to you. You got to let it kind of dictate what it needs to be and not forcing what it shouldn't be. And it's when done right as a player, when done right, you appreciate it. You know how it's going to be. And when you're playing through a course, like there's a natural transitions a lot of times where you'll walk off a basket and know exactly where to go because that's what makes the most sense.
Yeah.
That's intuitive as a player. And just, man, when it's done right, it's a work of art.
I agree.
I got to go back to something you said before I forget. You said that you've personally played, we'll call it professional research for everything else you just talked about. You've personally played over 1,500 courses in 49 states. Which one are you missing?
It's a state way up north. It's practically Canada. It's everybody always thinks it's going to be Alaska or Hawaii. But I had the privilege of knocking both those out in recent years. But it's North Dakota. I've been all 50. I've traveled through North Dakota when I was younger. I just never played it. Like, you got to go out of your way to play it. Like, geography, knowing a map, this thing is as north and central in the U.S. We never traveled through there for tournaments. And it's not just the 90. Like, you're looking at the 10, the 20, you're working your way up. It's not the 90. It's the 94. It's an other highway. You got to be going there to go there. You got to go out of your way to go there. And there's several times when I had some downtime, I started looking at flights to Fargo.
Yeah.
And just flying because. And playing for a weekend and maybe knocking out 10 courses. I try to play at least 10 courses per state. That way I get double digits per state. I try to play the oldest active course in every state. I'm on a quest right now to play every Steady Ed course. Talking about research, I want to learn. I'm a student of the game. And I'm trying to play every John Houck course. I probably have more John Houck course played than just about anybody. I know there's some players in Texas that have a bunch, but I'm trying to play as many of those as possible. And then trying to play the oldest course in every, the oldest course in every state, but also the oldest course in every country, the number one in every country. A lot of little sub goals within that. But like I said, I'm not the most versed with the highest number, but I probably have the most countries played for a North American. I know there's some European players, Derek Robbins, out of England, he has like 37 countries played, but for a player in the US, I am definitely the most traveled, and I played over, what is it? Did I hit 500? No, I hit 400, international courses, this past summer in Finland. So pretty good run.
And you said 22 countries so far?
23 countries, yep.
23 countries. Now, give me a country or two that you haven't made it to that's on the top of your list.
I want to play in Mexico.
You haven't got that one off the list.
Yeah, I had a chance to go down there a couple of years back, and it was around Thanksgiving. Didn't work out the schedule. Man, there's several new European countries I want to play in. I want to play in Africa. That's definitely one.
All right.
One of the continents I haven't played in South America yet. I haven't played Africa, and I haven't played in Antarctica yet.
Say Antarctica. You haven't played Antarctica?
Come on. I think it's like $10,000 to make the trip there. It's a flight to a boat, to a helicopter or something. It's outrageous. But McMurdo Station, it's a U.S. Weather station down there that has a temporary 9-hole course. And it's been on my wish.
There's a course already there?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Was picturing you grabbing a bunch of your disc golf park stuff, going down there, setting it up, playing it, picking it all back up, and flying back home in order to.
Yeah,
that's what I was picturing you'd have to do. But
there was an April Fool's maybe 3 or 4 years ago where it was Jay Redding. He was going to be the TD of the Sub-Arctic Open or something in Antarctica at McMurdo Station. And it was a whole like hoax being around April Fool's Day. But that's one of them I want to play. I played in Australia. New Zealand is epic. I played there. I actually, my last trip there last spring, a good friend of mine, Maverick Robinson, we played the Garden City Open in Christchurch on the South Island of New Zealand. A good friend, Leon Botha, had set this event up, invited us over there, and we played the event. And then we had a week after kind of free time. We had a rental vehicle, courtesy car, the tournament. And Maverick and I traveled through the entire South Island playing all 45 courses that they had available on the South Island in 6 days.
That hurts my arm. Just thinking about it. My arm hurts.
Several like six courses a day, 7 courses a day, sometimes 10 courses a day, some days. And we're going to be going back in March to conquer the North Island is the plan. So,
wow.
You're going to, Avery, appreciate, hopefully, Stat Mando. We were discussing when we had him on the show a few weeks back. of getting stats for the courses, just like we have our players. So you can pull up courses and be like, okay, who designed it? Was there a major title won at this course? When was it put, you know, just stats on courses too. Like how, it'd be awesome. I was going to say, how do you just Google and start researching when you're going to play these courses? Are you having to do all that on your own?
I'm good friends with the guys at UDisc. They do phenomenal work. The research that they put into, and even their, like their breakdowns and their stats and their summaries every year, they're above and beyond. I can't believe what the numbers they pull out for these courses and the rankings and the ratings and reviews. And I go off their list a lot of times, their top, 100 list and their top five per state. And I go off a lot of those lists. I'll look at the ranking of a course. If it's like a 4.5 or above, it's obviously going to be a notable course. But I'm definitely a super user of UDisc, and I access the app quite a bit to know where to go or where to play. And it helps guide a lot of my travels. A lot of old school course collectors still use like Disc Golf Course Review, which is another platform we used even after we started even using like the paperback actual PDGA course directory books in like the early 90s. And I still have several of those where I've highlighted courses that I used to play. And that was how we used to do it. But then I started kind of integrating, Disc Golf Course Review, and now it's UDisc is the king of that. But I had talked to the guys at UDisc and trying to incorporate having a section where you do have a course designer listed on every course, and then maybe some notable tournaments and things that happen there to kind of build the history. Because if we don't do it now, it's only going to get lost, and we can talk about it all day, but we need to have this stuff written, because there is a lot of players, new players ever since pandemic in the last, 3-4 years, that they want to hear about these things. They want to know about it. And if we don't talk about it or document it somewhere, it's gone. So man, StatMando is great for that as well. And I think maybe a little partnership between StatMando and UDisc to get that going will be really cool. I don't know. It's just a lot of fun. It is my hobby of collecting courses, and it just integrates perfectly to what I do and trying to perfect my craft as a disc golf course designer.
Well, we've been talking a long time, but we would be remiss if we didn't give you a chance to tell us what you've got working in the very near future. I don't know in the course of the last hour plus if we mentioned you just now getting it back from Hawaii, where you're putting a course in. I don't know the state of that, if it's about to open or if you're in the planning stages, but just briefly give us some idea of how we might run into or run across you over the course of, say, the next, 6 months or something here in 2024. What do you have going on?
A lot of designs is what I want. The course I designed in Hawaii, it was something I've been in discussion for the last 6 months. Finally agreed upon it and land the deal. I was trying to get out there even before the holidays, and it ended up working out where I got to wait till after the new year to fly out there. I had been to Hawaii one time, but not for a brief moment to play a couple courses, but I got a chance to be there for a full 8 days. When I landed the deal, it's at Turtle Bay Resort on the north shore of Oahu, Oahu being the main island, Honolulu being the big city there. And it's on the north shore, about an hour north of Honolulu. When my mom found out that I was going to Hawaii, she's like, "I'm coming too." She hasn't been to.
Dang.
And so she was just going to go out there and maybe help me out. And we had agreed upon that I was going to do the design and then help with the install a little bit. It turns out that we didn't get the assistance as much as I'd hoped. And my mom and I ended up installing the entire thing.
Dang.
With the help of Honolulu Disc Golf Club and a couple other volunteers. But we're out there in the sideways rain. It is the wet season in the wintertime. And we're out there packing gravel underneath wooden frames to do this multi-golf course, this foot golf disc golf course we built. It's 9 holes at the resort. It was a designated area of the resort that they weren't really using. There's two golf courses there, one designed by Palmer and the other one designed by Fazio. Very notable golfers, very notable designers. And I got a chance to, add my touch to the property with a 9-hole disc golf course. And 3 of the holes are literally right up on the Turtle Bay, right up on the Pacific Ocean. And epic, iconic location, the waves crashing, you get the breeze. And it's going to be a really cool course for the fact is it's very family friendly, very kid oriented. It is multi-golf, so it is foot golf, soccer golf, and then disc golf. 3 of the holes being plus 300 feet, 300 over, and then several in the 2 to 250 range. And man, what a great activity to incorporate at a resort, you know, for families and kids, that they can find something else to do. If they're playing golf or going to play in the ocean, they can play foot golf or disc golf. And we literally designed the course and built the course to 100% completion in a matter of 8 days.
Wow.
We were busting ourselves about 10 to 12 hours a day sometimes. Literally finished the course with an hour before sunset just to play the course and then fly out that night. my mom was tremendous help. She's the one that showed me disc golf course design. My parents, growing up in a disc golf family, my mom and dad always designed courses. They always took care of courses, maintained courses, built courses. And so everything she's always done, I learned from her and have her be part of this design and the build. It's one of a couple she's helped me throughout the years. I have another one in Washington, another one in Oklahoma here. She's helped me with directly on the design and even on the build. But we played this course an hour before sunset, flew out that night. And the phrase goes, my mom never played any disc golf in Hawaii. We literally had to build a course in the state of Hawaii. It was beautiful the way it worked out. I'm really happy with the results, and it's going to be a really popular course. So I'm just stoked to have, iconic Hawaiian course and a chance to go back there and visit there years to come.
I was going
to
say that makes for a great planned family vacation, like a repeater for sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But on top of that, several designs. I got one in Texas next week, another in Louisiana. I got another course design and build in Tennessee. Just talked to a gentleman today. I got another course in Indiana, Southern Indiana. I got to get back up to Kansas to do a course, another one up in Massachusetts. Possibility I might be designing one in New Zealand this year, if it all works out. So it's exciting and fun and just, I don't know, spontaneous in so many ways. And that's kind of how I live my life. So I always have as a touring player, but still to this day, there's so much going on, and it's so exciting to be a part of it all these years later, involved in the business side, but even in creating these courses, knowing that creating these courses and building these kind of courses is just helping the growth and hopefully generating a lot more players for future generations.
Someone please from North Dakota, give Avery a call.
Yeah.
We've got to mark this off the list.
I've tried to land a design up there for the last couple of years and got close on a few of them. It didn't work out. I was trying to find another reason to get up there with a course design, and maybe it works, maybe it doesn't. But if I got to get up there, I'll get up there at some point to knock off number 50.
Nice.
Well, we see you at Pro Worlds in Virginia, or maybe Masters Worlds in Emporia. That's not too far a drive for you.
I think I'll definitely try to attend and be a part of like spectating and watching Masters Worlds in Emporia. And then I have full intentions to play the World Championships in Virginia. Got the door shut on me last year trying to play in Vermont for my 24th consecutive.
Mm.
And so hopefully I can play in Virginia and then play next year in Finland for my 24th and 25th. And I might just might hang it up on the World Championships after I play 25 is kind of the plan in my eyes. So
no intentions on playing Masters Worlds?
No.
It's a fun life being a master golfer. I'm just going to say, it's kind of fun.
Not for any reasons, but I like playing with the kids. They definitely keep me young and energetic, and it's definitely an honor and a privilege to play at the World Championships all these years and to attend all these, you know, since the early 90s, but to be at these ones. And it's fun playing tournaments, man. It's fun hanging out at tournaments these days though, too. Like you're talking about hanging out at Junior Worlds. Hope we can hang out and then talk at that point as well.
Yeah.
But you know, you head up to Emporia and watch Masters Worlds or, you know, European Open last year. I was just there. I plan on going there again, but if it's Junior Worlds, I got to make a call, I guess. But I like just being a part of events as well. And I kind of learned that in like the 2016, 2017 era when I was doing a lot of commentary for the Disc Golf World Tour. Being a part of event and not having the stress over playing, but being there and soaking up and still being a part of the event and hanging out with all my friends and disc golf family at that point. Yeah. So it's fun no matter if you're playing or you're just there to attend and spectate disc golf tournaments where it's at.
Avery Jenkins, guest with us today on PDGA Radio with a lifetime of accomplishments and stories. And that's a lot done in really a half a lifetime's worth of time. So maybe 45 years from now, we'll have you back again and you can tell us what you did in the second half. That's it. But anyway, wish you the best of luck. Can't wait to get out to some of these designs of yours. I've been to some of them. Now I just want to go and try to knock out a few more. So I'm going to be doing the best that I can to look them up every time I travel this year to see if there's an Avery Jenkins layout in the area where I'm going. I might have to negotiate with my family to stay an extra day every now and then on some of these trips just to get out and play another course. But Avery, we appreciate you joining us. We know how busy you are. Good grief. But it was a lot of fun, and we will see you down the road.
Awesome. Looking forward to it. Thanks, guys. It was great talking with you. A lot to talk about. Disc golf is exciting, and there's so many stories within that. But I appreciate having me on and kind of discussing the lifestyle of what it is as a touring player. But, you know, it's a good place we're at now, and I appreciate your time and hearing these.
All right, brother. We'll see you.
Thank you very much. Have a good night.